which is renormalization. And here you kind of try to systematically eliminate degrees of freedom to kind of identify universal features of a face. And so entanglement renormalization is basically motivated by this technique. I won't say too much more about renormalization, because even though it's motivated by renormalization group techniques, you should really think of it as a variational ansatz. So the way it was originally defined, it was a family of states for multi-qubit systems. So let me define this ansatz. And as you can see here, it's clearly motivated by quantum computation or quantum circuits. So just suppose you have a quantum circuit which prepares a certain state of n qubits. So it takes some all zero product state and transforms it into an n qubit state. And perhaps we want to impose some conditions on the shape of these circuits. So let's just say this is logarithmic depth. So you can really think of a quantum algorithm or a quantum circuit which efficiently prepares this quantum state of n qubits. And there will actually be additional constraints on the shape of this circuit, because our goal is not really to prepare it on a quantum computer, but to actually compute expectation values and so on a classical computer. But logarithmic depth is just one of the criteria which will be important. So now, you can think of this circuit as a state preparation circuit, or you can also say that it actually describes a state, because clearly, well, it actually describes a variational family, because we can change the set of unitaries. So for every family of unitaries we put into the circuit, we get different states. And in this way, we can associate a family of variational states to every circuit diagram. So let me simplify this a little bit. And one thing you might have observed is that all these unitaries are applied to specific input states, where one part is it's just a zero state. So these are always product states. And in other words, we're not actually using the whole information contained in these unitaries, and we can replace them by isometries. So that's just a different way of saying this. So now we're going to actually vary over isometries, and we also get a simplified circuit diagram. So this will be useful for various reasons, but for now we've just reduced the number of parameters by eliminating some irrelevant ones. Of course, the defining property of such an isometry is that if you apply the adjoint of an isometry to itself, then you get the identity. And this is somewhat trivial, but let me write this down in circuit notation, or you can think of this as a tensor contraction if you wish. Then whenever you have two of these boxes paired up, with one containing the isometry and the other one containing the adjoint, then it will basically disappear. And this is actually the most important identity for this talk in some ways. So this is important. So before telling you why it's important and how we actually compute things for such states, let me give you some reasons why people believe that this is a good variational ansatz. And perhaps the original motivation was that you could, in principle, run the circuit backwards. And by doing that, you kind of disentangle certain degrees of freedom, which are decoupled in these zero product states. And then you discard these degrees of freedom. And you can continue doing this. And in this sense, it's a renormalization group scheme, because you successively coarse-grain your state. And you kind of removing entanglement at short distance scales at this level, and then longer and longer distance scales at higher levels. So we kind of expect to be able to describe states that have a sort of hierarchical organization of the entanglement. And well, you can now go ahead and experiment with this and see whether it actually works for certain spin systems, like the Ising model or the Potts model. And it turns out that, indeed, it seems to describe critical systems pretty well. So there's some numerical work. But then there are also some theoretical reasons why you could argue that this seems to be a good class of states. For example, you have a logarithmic entanglement entropy in the block size in one dimensions, and this is a property that, for example, matrix product states with a fixed bond dimension don't have. So clearly this is a good thing if you want to describe systems that have this kind of scaling of the entropy. And also there are some interesting states like the ground state of the toric code, which can be exactly described by an ansatz like this. So you can write down circuits that prepare these efficiently on a quantum computer, for example. And then there are, of course, some numerical reasons. The most important of which is probably this one, that this method, in principle, can be applied in any dimension. And this is not the case, for example, for DMRG type techniques. So, and we have these ways of computing quantities we're interested in. So let me explain how we actually compute expectation values in such a state. And this is very simple. So what you do is you just write down the state, the local observable, whose expectation value you're interested in, and then the adjoint of the state. And clearly, this kind of tensor network, if you evaluate it by summing over all the basis states for the edges, you end up with the expectation value in that state. This is generally true for any kind of tensor network state. So at this point, you might think that it's actually hard computationally to evaluate this expectation values because there are many unitaries or isometries involved. But it turns out that only a few of them actually contributes to this expectation value, and there are those that are in the so-called causal cone of the operator. So here's where the additional restriction on the circuit diagram comes in. You want this causal cone to be of finite width. And this implies that only a logarithmic number of isometries contributes. Now, the way to see this is to apply this identity we had before to just simplify this diagram. So here you see this will be the adjoint of an isometry, or in this case, even unitary, paired up with itself. So we can cancel this, and the same down here. And you continue until you've really eliminated all the isometries or unitaries outside the causal cone. And in this way, you end up with a simplified tensor network, which now only has a logarithmic number of isometries. And this can now be efficiently computed simply because it's a small tensor network. And this is really the whole story. So here's a summary. So you start with a certain tree-like graph, which you interpret as a circuit. Then you associate isometries or unitaries to the internal boxes and a certain state to the box at the top, the rightmost box. And then the way you compute, say, expectation value is just very simple. You write down this tensor network. You first simplify it using this cancellation of isometries, and then you end up with a small tensor network, which you can efficiently contract. So now what's going to be different when we move to anions will be that instead of isometries, we will have to choose certain charge-preserving isometries. So this will be sort of block diagonal matrices. And instead of getting a tensor network after the simplifications, we will get some superposition of label graphs, which we can evaluate. So there are some invariants associated with such graphs. But the story will be pretty similar in some ways. Okay, so let me conclude this introduction to entanglement renormalization by just mentioning that you can look at different subclasses of such ansatz states. For example, instead of using different isometries everywhere, you could try to use the same unitary or isometry, at every level. So this is called a translation invariant mirror, although you have to be careful about translation invariants. But the point here is that you have a much smaller number of isometries. So previously, you had n times the depth, so the n times log n isometries. Here, you only have a constant times log n isometries because you chose them the same here. And, of course, the number of parameters also scales with a qubit dimension. Each isometry is described by a polynomial number of parameters in the qubit dimension. So overall, we get a polynomial in the intense log n parameters. And then you can even go further and say, well, what if you choose these isometries to be the same at every level of coarse graining? And in this case, you actually get, this parameter n, the system size doesn't even come in. So you have a constant number of parameters. And with this, you can, in principle, go to the thermodynamic limit and consider a large system. Of course, it will sort of only describe states that have a certain scale invariance property. So they look kind of the same at all distances. But in this sense, this can be useful because you can study large systems, which you couldn't do otherwise. OK, so now I will move to the second part of my talk, and I would like to give you some background about these anions and basically introduce the Hamiltonians we would like to study before I actually give you a variational ansatz which, for these particular systems. So let me begin with just a few words about topological order in general. So for the purpose of this talk, I don't really care where this system comes from. You could think of electrons moving on a surface, but it could also be a qubit lattice system embedded in a surface. The important thing, it's a two-dimensional system that can be defined on any 2D surface. And there's some interesting Hamiltonian on it, like Kitaev's Torrey code or some other Hamiltonian which leads to topological order. And what I mean by that is the properties that are important for the purpose of this talk are these two. So we have a ground space which scales with the topology of the surface. So for example, if you have n holes in the surface, then this ground space will be exponentially large in the number of holes. And the second property is that this degenerate ground space is separated from the rest of the spectrum by a finite gap, even in the thermodynamic limit. And furthermore, this gap remains even if you perturb the system. So even if you add a perturbation, local perturbations to this Hamiltonian, we still have this separation. And this is why it's generally thought to be a good idea to kind of store quantum information in this ground space. It's exponentially large, and it kind of stays separated even if you have local perturbations. Of course, this is sort of assuming zero temperature. But so now, let me be a little bit more precise about this stability under perturbations. And really, what happens is, of course, that you do get an energy splitting once you turn on perturbations. But this energy splitting is exponentially small in the size of the system. And this has been established rigorously for families of, commuting Hamiltonians like the Torrey code by Pravi, Hastings, and Michalakis. And in general, there are perturbative arguments that support this kind of claim. So we have this exponentially small energy splitting, and now we can ask how these low energy degrees of freedom actually behave. So, and this is really the question that this anionic entanglement renormalization ansatz addresses, is basically how can we describe these states, and to understand this, we have to first kind of come up with a model for these low energy degrees of freedom. So I have to do two things. I have to first describe what this ground space looks like, and then also how a Hamiltonian could be defined that just acts on these low energy states. So what an effective Hamiltonian is for these degrees of freedom. By the way, if you have questions, please interrupt me. Okay, so I will let me just give you a different picture of why you get this energy splitting, which is perhaps more intuitive. So really, this case where we have perfect degeneracy kind of corresponds to a case where these holes on the surface are infinitely far apart. So you can think of the holes as sort of particles or anions. And once you start moving them closer, they start to interact. And this is basically the process that leads to this energy splitting. And, physicists, I guess, like to draw these Feynman-like diagrams where here you kind of see an exchange of a virtual anion between these two particles because they're close. And it turns out that
well, you can actually make sense of these diagrams. You can and you can show that any perturbations, in fact, decomposes into such exchanges of virtual anions. So this is just motivation. So now I would like to tell you what this ground space looks like, and then how a perturbation can act on this ground space. And that's where a conservation law will come in. Okay, so here's a description of the ground space in general. And basically, I'm giving you a recipe for writing down a basis of this space. So as I said, the Hilbert space, the ground space, depends on the surface. So what we do is we take a so-called Pentz decomposition of the surface. And associated with that is a certain trivalent graph. And now the basis vectors are all labelings of this graph with certain consistency conditions. So these are called fusion rules. So we have a certain set of labels. And they can meet at the vertex if they're sort of fusion consistent. And you should think of the labels as, say, the total angular momentum of a particle. And then if you bring two together, then they will fuse to some angular momentum that's between the difference and the sum. So this is basically the spin analog of these fusion rules. So basically, a state in this space will now be some superposition of such labeled graphs. And we can also look at different surfaces. But one thing I would like to mention first is that we will usually fix the labels on the boundary. And that just corresponds to considering a particle with a fixed, or three particles with fixed total spins each. So we'll, in this case, we'll talk about three anions of type A1, A2, and A3 with total charge C. And then the only degree of freedom in this case would be this internal label H. So more generally, you could, for example, consider a torus with two holes, which decomposes into two pens. And then a basis would look something like this, where these labels are kind of periodic. If you generalize this, we get basically a state space of n A-type anions on the torus, which looks something like this. So let me give you a more concrete example. If you consider the Fibonacci theory, there are only two non-trivial particles. I mean, there's a so-called trivial particle, which usually means that there's actually no particle at all. But then there's the other label, the one label, which is the Fibonacci particle. And now if you consider, say, three of these Fibonacci particles, which are denoted by one, then the fusion rules basically tell you that you cannot have a single one particle at the vertex. And what this means is that these internal degrees of freedom, they will correspond to bit strings that have no consecutive zeros. So all these four configurations are allowed in this case. And in this way, you can see that you can actually embed this Hilbert space into a product space of qubits. But in general, if you go to n anions, then the number of such allowed states will be much smaller than 2 to the n. So even though you could embed these anionic states into a product space of qubits, that might not generally be a good idea. In fact, the more anions you have, I mean, this scales only as essentially the n's Fibonacci number, or 1.6 to the n. If we embedded that in the trivial way into qubits, then you get a much larger space. So computationally, this is actually not a good idea. And in fact, this is true in general. So suppose we don't look at Fibonacci, at the Fibonacci model, but a different kind of anion, then you can again embed this into a state space of, into space CD to the n, where D is the number of different particle labels in the theory. But in general, this number will be larger than the so-called quantum dimension and of the particle you're considering. So if you have n A-type particles, then the Hilbert space will be roughly exponential in dA, where dA is the particle, the quantum dimension of particle A. So again, this shows that you shouldn't try to work with anions by embedding them into qubits or qudits. In fact, there are other reasons that will be more important, because when you do this embedding, you kind of obscure the meaning of charge preservation, for example. So this is what I will talk about next. But just one thing I should clarify is that I told you that you can get a basis of this Hilbert space by looking at the pens decomposition and considering all labelings. Well, of course, you could have looked at the different pens decomposition, and you would have obtained a different basis of the space. And so there will be an object called the F matrix, which is basically a unitary, which takes you from this basis to the other basis. And in the spin context, this is usually known as the 6J symbol. OK, so now let me use this to define or to tell you how local operators can act on these anionic states. So suppose we have a system like this, and we would like to act with a local operator on three of these anions, three neighboring anions. And somehow you would expect that it should only affect labels in this region. But to define this precisely, you have to actually choose a different basis in which basically the boundary of this support is corresponds to a pen segment. And then the basis will have a tree-like shape. And then the local operator can only affect labels inside this tree. So this is what a local operator does. And it will preserve, in particular, this label C, which is called the total charge of the region. So in principle, it's an observable quantity, which you can measure by going around the boundary of this region A. And this will be preserved. And that's analogous to, say, parity conservation for fermions. So that then you just have even operators. But this is the most general form of a local three-anion operator. So in this case, it will only affect this label and this subtree B. And of course, you can forget about the rest of the chain. Just consider this action on this subtree. So you see that the total charge is preserved. Or in other words, if you write it in Brouquet notation, well, you just get a block diagonal matrix with blocks corresponding to the total charge of the region. And it will turn out to be convenient to kind of turn the second part around. And then we will represent operators by superpositions of trees like this. And you will see why this is useful. And so again, a local operator, this is the most general form of a local operator. And the parameters are basically, they correspond to different blocks, a block diagonal matrix, with blocks indexed by the total charge. OK, so now here are two very simple examples. So the first one is an interaction between two anions. And it's a block diagonal matrix, which just contains one non-zero block. The block is the identity. It's the projection onto the trivial charge. So you can just, this is analogous to say, the projection onto the singlet state of two spins. And in the same way, you can define a three-anion interaction. And once you have this kind of interactions, you can make up models, for example, a model for a chain, and this is analogous to writing down a Heisenberg-Hamiltonian for a chain of spins. So here we just have two local interactions between every neighboring pair of anions, and then we have some three local interactions. And this kind of model has been studied before. It was originally called, considered in the Fibonacci case, and was called the golden chain, with just these two local interactions. And in that case, there's even an exact solution. And well, these models are interesting for a number of reasons. For example, they have very rich phase diagrams, as we will see. So, so now, the rest of this talk, I will basically give you a variational ansatz for this kind of Hamiltonian. And I will show you that, well, some numerical evidence that it actually works. But before that, I would like to explain a little bit more about this anionic formalism and the reason why we write down operators in this strange form, apart from charge conservation. So the reason is really that we have simple computational rules. So we've seen that a state is basically a superposition of labeled graphs like this, an operator the same, but a slightly different graph. The point of this representation is that you can, for example, take joints just by flipping the diagram and complex conjugating the coefficients. You can also multiply, say, an operator to a state, and you get kind of a superposition of diagrams like this. And this might be somewhat confusing, but because this is not, this doesn't correspond to a basis state. It doesn't have the right, it doesn't correspond to fancy composition. But in fact, there are some rules that allow you to reduce any such diagram to a superposition of basis states. And you should think of these rules as essentially basis transformations. So I guess I don't really, I won't really explain this, but these are essentially the rules. You can deform the strings, you can eliminate loops, and so on. Here's just an example calculation. So you successively apply these rules, and in the end, you end up with the superposition of basis states. So this might be somewhat confusing, but the point I would like to stress here is that it doesn't matter in what order you do this, and this is because of the property of these 6J symbols. They have to satisfy very strong algebraic conditions, which make sure that this is well defined. And the other point I would like to stress here is that as long as your initial graph is kind of small, then it can obviously be done efficiently. So this will be important. And at this point, you might realize that there's a very close analogy between this anionic formalism and tensor networks. In fact, if you consider, for example, an expectation value of a local operator, it has essentially the same form, except that we should not think of this graph as a tensor network, but as a scalar. So there are certain rules which allow you to evaluate this to a scalar. And so instead of just contracting a tensor, we have to kind of sum over all these labelings and then compute the scalar using these rules. You have to sum over graph invariants. Yes?
And on the other subspaces?
Well, yeah, I guess it's correct because in this case you can't really, it's not a tensor product space. Mm-hmm. So you can identify these lines with subspaces.
In that case, you have like subspaces like basis vectors.
Yes, I mean, this part is really a basis vector. Mm-hmm. And this is a basis vector. Mm-hmm. There's on this side, you would have basis vector for every line. You would have sum over these. Yeah. OK. So now let me use this basically to define entanglement renormalization for anions. And the point of this ansatz is that it really kind of exploits the structure of the Hilbert space. And it allows you, for example, to apply this to two-dimensional arrangements of anions. So far, I've only talked about chains of anions. OK, so here's the definition of the ansatz. And it's very similar to what we had before. You just choose a certain tree-like graph. And now we associate variational parameters to every vertex or every box. And whereas before, this kind of box would be associated with a three-qubit state. In this case, it will be a three-anion state. And these isometries, we now use charge-preserving isometries. In other words, block diagonal matrices indexed by the total charge. So these are the variational parameters. And now the way that the state is defined is simply by inserting these parameters into the diagram of all. So just as a simple example, if you have this kind of diagram, then the state will be this formal linear combination of these guys here. So that's the definition of the state. And in general, this might be, if you want to reduce this to a linear combination of basis states, this might be pretty difficult because there are many such isometries involved. So in principle, we could do we could manipulate this graph and get a linear combination of basis states. But it turns out that we don't actually need to do this if you're only interested in, say, expectation values. So this is the definition of the state. I haven't told you how you compute expectation values efficiently. But the way you compute it is very analogous to before. And the reason is that these charge-preserving isometries, they satisfy the same property as these normal isometries. And in diagrammatic notation, again, if they're paired up, you can, they just cancel each other. And well, this would be, in graph notation, the same identity. So if you stack the adjoint to itself, you get the identity. And that means that we can evaluate expectation values in the same way as we did before. So you just start with this kind of not tensor network in this case, but superposition of labeled graphs. But then you simplify it first using these substitutions. And you end up with a simplified network, which you can now evaluate using the local rules. So the simplification does not lead to a tensor network, but it leads to a small diagram which you can evaluate. So that's a basic idea. So the difference is that we don't have tensor contractions, but at least formally we have the same substitution rules. And that's what makes it efficient to compute local expectation values. And in this way, you can basically adapt all these techniques for spin chains to anions. Just a word about parameters. You now see that basically we have the same number of isometries. One important difference is, of course, that these isometries are now log diagonal. And this is important, especially for numerics, because you have to do singular value decompositions to optimize the energy. And so this will be an improvement. The other improvement is, of course, what I mentioned before, this quantum dimension. Instead of having all particle labels, we can now just deal with a polynomial in the quantum dimension of the particle. So you might say that this is only a polynomial improvement in the number of parameters. But in fact, this is usually a relatively high degree polynomial for computational purposes. So it really makes a difference.
The home of using this projector, is this general,
it applies to any Hamiltonian. It doesn't need to be projectors.
It's pi operator. It doesn't have to be pi.
No, it doesn't. It needs to be a local, a sum of local terms.
Then why did you somehow mention this Hamiltonian?
Oh, I just gave it as an example of a Hamiltonian that's been studied in the literature, and that's kind of, I mean, it's kind of a paradigmatic example, like the Heisenberg model for spins. But you could look at, you can apply this to any such Hamiltonian, as long as it's local, it consists of locally charge-preserving terms. Actually, you can adapt the answers also to non-charge preserving Hamiltonians, but I didn't talk about this. So please. Okay. So let's see whether this actually works, and we try to minimize the energy over this set of states for exactly this Hamiltonian that I introduced before. So we have these three local interactions. With public strengths J2 and the two local interactions, and we will have a parameter theta, which basically controls the ratio between these two coupling strengths. Mm-hmm. So here, this axis is just this parameter, and this is the ground state energy. And this is just for small systems, which we can exactly diagonalize. So we can compare our answers to the exact values, and the red dots are, the red circles are the exact values, and you see pretty good agreement over this whole range of parameters. And maybe just a few things you can do with this. So you can, for example, take the derivative of this energy, and you see that for example, the second derivative actually jumps in these locations, which really correspond to the phase boundaries that have been studied before. So this is the phase diagram obtained by PMRD methods, by Trepsidon. So there are two gap phases and some critical phases, and these are the exactly solvable points and so on. Here we're really just computing the ground state energy. Okay, so then another test you can do is you can try to go to larger systems.
Sorry, say again. So the one on the left is your ansatz, and the one on the right is the exact?
Oh, no, this is just the derivative of the variationally obtained energies.
Okay.
So the dependence on this parameter theta is apparently good enough. Like, if you change the Hamiltonian a little bit, then this variationally obtained transit energy actually jumps at the phase boundaries. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very rudimentary thing you can try to do with this kind of plot. But at least these states, I mean, the ground states seem to be well described. In fact, there's a point here, 3π/2, where we can actually write down what this ansatz is. So we have an exact fixed point of this RG scheme. We can have an analytical solution. And you see how the error, I mean, this is an iterative optimization procedure. Here the error goes down indeed. Okay, so the other thing we want to see was, maybe one more thing, you can consider correlation functions. And so this is just the bond point in the phase diagram, and you see the correlation decay algebraically with the distance, and again, you get the agreement with the exact values. Okay, so the other thing you might try to do is consider larger systems, and here the problem is, of course, that we cannot exactly diagonalize the system anymore, so it's hard. It's not clear what we should compare it to, but at certain points in the phase diagram, it's known what the continuum limit of the model is, so it's a so-called antiferromagnetic point. The corresponding conformal field theory is known, and what this means is we get a prediction for the conformal spectrum, which is parameterized, well, it has two non-universal parameters, and then the so-called conformal weights. So this comes from a representation of the Virasoro algebra. And basically what we can do is we can use the exact values, let's say 16 anions, to estimate these non-universal constants. And then from that we can extrapolate to, in this case, 128 anions. And we compare this to this ansatz, and it seems like we can accurately reproduce the ground state energy per site. And in fact, there's a related work by Pfeiffer et al. And they show that with these techniques, you can actually go to the thermodynamic limit and extract CFT data, like these conformal weights or critical exponents, using the same kind of method. So this is pretty nice. Of course, it only works in cases where, where you have this kind of CFT description, it wouldn't work in gap phase. And I think Pfeiffer and Crawford, they consider this point in the phase diagram. So how much time do I have left?
10 minutes.
So I guess, let me just tell you a little bit about two-dimensional arrangements of anions. And you might have been wondering why I didn't talk about grading, even though I'm talking about non-abelian particles or exchange statistics. And, well, really, grading doesn't come in if you just look at one-dimensional chains of anions. But it comes in, for example, if you consider next and nearest neighbor interactions, because in principle, you can think of two processes in which this particle can interact with this one. It could either travel this way or that way. And then if you assume that they kind of have an interaction here, exchange a virtual particle, then you get two different Hamiltonians corresponding to these processes.
And of course, to make sense of these diagrams, there has to be an additional object, the R matrix, which tells you how to resolve these crossings. So these are unitary operations when we apply this rule. And then it turns out that these processes, if you write them down as Hamiltonians, they become three anion operators. And a similar thing happens if you, for example, consider an anionic array like so, and you want to write down nearest neighbor interactions. So what you have to do is you have to choose an ordering of these holes. You write down a basis. The basis will look the same as before because it only depends on the topology of the surface. So this will just give this basis. Now, if you consider a nearest neighbor interaction, which interacts between 1, 2, 2, 4, 3, 4, and 1, 3, you basically have to bring these particles next to each other before you can interact. And in this way, you get terms like this. And again, this will be non-local operators. I mean, there will be more non-local than just these two anion interactions. So if you consider larger arrays, you might be worried that you now have to compute the expectation values of highly non-local operators. But it turns out that, in fact, this is not so serious, because if you have a non-local operator which has this particular form, then you can reduce the computation of this expectation value to the computation of a local operator in a related state. And the related state is also an annealing contaminant renormalization state. So there's a way of computing a new set of isometries from this set of isometries that that is relatively efficient, as long as, I mean, it's polynomial in the number of crossings. And so basically what you have to do is you have to be careful about how you choose the ordering of your anions, and to keep the number of crossings small. And this kind of problem has been considered in a fermionic setting, because there you have a similar problem as you need to order the fermions. And the way it works is, of course, you use basically gradients. So this, I'll probably skip this. I mean, you want to compute an expectation value of this kind of operator. And what you do is you absorb these grades into these isometries. So here I've just moved this around. And here basically I'm applying this unitary to this isometry, and I get a new isometry. And you can continue until you have a new state, the new isometries, and it's really a local expectation value of this trick. So this is how you could, in principle, treat two-dimensional arrangements. There might be other ways. And finally, I would like to mention another interpretation that these circuits have. And obviously, they have the same interpretation as for qubits. You can think of this kind of anionic ansatz as a preparation circuit for a multi-anion state. But in fact, you can also go backwards. And you can think of running backwards as a procedure for creating a certain state of what I call composite anions. And it turns out to be operationally useful, at least theoretically, to do this kind of thing. So the motivation is for this so-called composite anion distillation is that we would like to do a topological computation. And to do that, we usually encode a zero state, a logical zero, and a logical one into states of number of anions. So in this case, just four Fibonacci anions. And then we do computational gates by braiding these, and finally we measure some charge. And the idea is that, well, these breaks are inherently robust in some sense, because the information stays encoded, so all these gates are in some sense transversal. And but of course, measurement is more problematic. So here you have to decode. You have to kind of do something non-topological. But again, this measurement at the end of the computation is not that problematic, because you can just repeat it and amplify your, well, correctness probability, if you wish. So the only question, perhaps, is how do we actually prepare this initial state? And And can this be done in a robust manner? So let's consider a very simple setting where this preparation cannot be done perfectly. Instead, we assume that we can sort of act locally on this surface and create pairs probabilistically. So we can kind of shoot something at the surface, and with certain probability, you get a pair here and a pair here. But in principle, you don't know where these pairs are. In fact, we can even assume that our state is some coherent superposition of such states which have pairs in certain locations. Now, obviously, one approach to doing computation with this is we could just measure these locations and see there's a pair here, there's a pair here, and then just compute these remaining pairs. But as I said before, measurements are not inherently robust. So the question is, can we actually do this without any measurements? And it turns out that this is possible, at least in this idealized setting, by basically applying certain unitaries which concentrate the entropy. So the procedure is like this. We start with a state, which is some superposition or perhaps a mixture of states which have particle pairs in certain locations. And we would like to turn this, say, into a pure state of, say, just one pair. So we would like to apply a unitary to this mixed state to get a pure state. And obviously, this is wrong. What we get is an additional mixed state, but it should be a tensor product with this pure state. So you can understand this as a subsystem code. We have a part of the Hilbert space which corresponds to encoded information, and then a second part which just collects the garbage, essentially. And the goal is to find such unitaries, and for this we have to decide how we encode anions. So this is kind of an encoded pair of anions. And then you want kind of this property of this unitary. Any state in the subspace gets mapped to a product state, so this part is pure. So let me tell you what this encoded anions will be. And they're something very physical. So they're pretty natural in the sense that an encoded anion will simply be a larger region of your lattice or your surface. So this is like concatenation of codes. So here we would just have an encoding of 0 and 1, and then we would replace every symbol here by the code word itself and so on, and build up larger and larger codes. We can do something similar here. We could either work with bare physical anions, which really correspond to holes in the surface, but we could also say that, well, just take a region which maybe contains two holes, and just say treat this region as one particle. And I will call this a composite anion. And then we can take composite anions and build up larger regions which contain composite anions and so on. And in the anionic formalism, this just corresponds to considering only this lower part of the diagram. So here we're only interested in the total charge of this region and of this region, and we will try to get kind of a trivial charge in total, but we don't care about what's inside these regions. So these are these composite anions. That's the idea. And now it turns out that you can write down a circuit which achieves this. Suppose you have states like this, so we have either a pair here, pair here, or pairs in both locations, then we would like to get a unitary which maps us to a state which always has topological charge in this part and topological non-trivial charge in this part. And you can construct this, I won't go into the details here, but this can be done. And then what you do is you just concatenate the scheme, so you use larger and larger regions. I should probably mention that actually these composite regions, that you can think of them as anions, in fact, you can even abrade them efficiently, at least for certain systems. Or you could also think of just pushing these anions together and using them as one. But in this way, you can actually continue doing this until you end up with a composite anion pair. And when you look at this, it looks very similar to this entanglement renormalization. In fact, the connection is pretty simple. You can say that if you have such a entanglement renormalization ansatz and the top level state has a particular form, then this ansatz corresponds essentially to a distillation scheme which distills this state of positive endings. So there's a connection between this ansatz and this distillation scheme. In fact, you can sort of understand this as a characterization of states that are distillable in this sense. And well, of course, there's one additional assumption we have to make on these unitaries or isometries, and this is the assumption that we can actually implement them. But they should be composed of braids and fusion. Fusion just means that you go to a larger region which contains these particles. Mm-hmm. So this subclass of anionic entanglement renormalization states corresponds to states that can be distilled into composite endings. Okay, so this is basically all I want to talk about. So we have this variational family of ansatz states and some numerical evidence that it actually works. It also has this connection to this anionic state distillation. And in principle, you should apply this to two-dimensional systems and also generalize, for example, to PEPs or MPS states or other tensor product states. And this has been considered by Pfeiffer and Clusters. Okay, this is it.
I'm surprised it works. It seems a sort of a swindle, but I see how you can do it.
Well, we didn't know initially whether it works.
Yeah. Actually, I'm wondering, I suppose you have the multiple degeneracy in the ground state, right?
Yes.
And how do you handle this? Because it looks like basically you have the multiple targets in the entanglement renormalization. But how somehow this renormalization flow converges?
I mean, you basically preserve this degeneracy as you go to higher levels, of course, right?
That's fine, but you are somehow the ground set is not unique, right? So, but
yes,
how
that's
do you
fine.
Somehow handle this? But you don't have fewer states, formally speaking.
I guess that's true. I mean, this essentially applies only to pure states. But the point is that for any ground state, any element of the ground space that's pure, it gives you a description. Because, what you're doing is, you're mapping the system to a similar system which has the same degeneracy. And I'm talking about the case where this description is exact. For example, for the Tori code, we can renormalize by mapping it to new Tori codes, which have fewer spins. And what happens there is that every ground state gets mapped to an analogous ground state in the coarse grain system. So you don't lose any.
Maybe operators are different. So I guess as far as you somehow evaluate local operators, I think it doesn't matter to you which ground state.
That's
is.
Right.
This is somehow idea. But suppose say we like to evaluate the gap, then can you still do that? Because you have also tiny splitting, right, if you introduce a perturbation.
Yes. So for this sense, there's no procedure to evaluate non-local operators. Because this simplification is really based on the fact that these local operators have a finite causal column. And so you can't actually distinguish that. There are procedures for computing, say, two-point correlation functions.
Any more questions? Okay, so let's thank Robert.